This is the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified podcast. So, what's on the docket for today?
Not much. I think it's going to be a really easy, light kind of news day. There hasn't been a whole lot in there, but I have been going back through the Ubiquiti information that was leaked out last week from the whistleblower and really starting to dive into a lot of that information and want to kind of touch on that, see if you're seeing the same things I am and if this really is something to be concerned about. What do you got on your side, sir?
Not much. I'm just more concerned that this is the calm before the storm. This is the second week that we're going into without any major incidents, and I'm wondering if the bad actors are just laying in wait to start striking again.
Yeah, we definitely start talking about that, at least what I'm seeing on the incident response side of things. It's very, very interesting, very quiet. And the ones that we are getting, it's a little bit of a different conversation in the past couple of weeks that I'm not really used to having a whole lot of. So we'll definitely dive into that. So I guess let's kick it off with the Ubiquiti. Do you remember that Ubiquiti whistleblower article that came out toward the end of last week, I think, or middle of last week?
Yeah, the one from last week where it should have been all hands on deck because of how they deliberately avoided disclosure.
Mm-hmm. Did you really dive into that whistleblower? And I'm going to lead down this little rabbit hole here.
I read the entire article. I think Bleeping Computer may have been the first one that I read, and there were a few after the fact and some confirmations of the breach. But Ubiquiti still has not come out and actually said what was exposed, what may have been exposed. And they keep towing the line that there's no evidence that user data was accessed, much less exfiltrated, which I can only believe that because of the article saying there was little to no logging.
Exactly. And this is kind of the stuff that we always lead back to. It's like, you're not going to see the weeds in your grass if you don't open your eyes, right? If you're not logging these things, of course, there's no evidence of this stuff done because there's nothing to show it. But the one thing that I did find very, very interesting is a couple of the spinoff articles and stuff like that. And I think it may have actually been Bleeping Computer that I was reading this on, but Ubiquiti was blaming a third party vendor originally and said that it was, you know, no, that was where the whole no information was coming out before the whistleblower actually came out. Now that we're looking at the whistleblower, so Ubiquiti is pretty much blaming AWS since all their stuff is in AWS as their third-party vendor with the data breach?
From what I gather, it was a breached LastPass account that got them privileged access to Ubiquiti backend. I could be mistaken, but that's what
I
read.
So what I was reading, because they were actually showing login or a LastPass screens. So they breached somebody's computer, whether that's an AWS computer, whether that's a local VM or whatever. But there was, you know, they were logged into Windows showing LastPass up. Inside of those LastPass credentials were the SSH code for any and all Ubiquiti servers in AWS, any and all critical system admins to all of their containers, whoever they got into. Was quote unquote God mode and had access to the entire kingdom. This would be the equivalent of you or I getting compromised and having access to our identity. It's really that same level. It's like, here's the keys. I'm just walking away type of thing.
Here's my issue with what we know about this whole Ubiquiti fiasco, which let's be honest, we don't actually know much of anything other than hearsay coming from various points. But the mere fact that there was no controlled access and one account can do this much damage, that scares me. Yes, we should always secure the identity as best we can, but no single identity should be able to do this type of damage. And that is really poor cybersecurity hygiene or just poor IT hygiene in general, from my point of view.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it goes back to what we've been talking about on the past couple episodes a little bit and privately, where who are you going to start aligning your vendors with? You know, like I said on the call when we originally talked about this, I got a ton of Ubiquiti stuff out there. I don't know, short of starting to pull everything out and go with a different vendor, I'm not really sure what to do.
I don't know if you remember, maybe a year ago, just under a year ago, internally here, my SOC and SIM found out that the unified devices were passing their passwords in plain text. You recall that?
I do recall that conversation. Yes, sir.
I reached out to Ubiquiti, never got a response, and I ended up ripping and replacing every bit of Unify, which at that point were only switches because I use other vendors for firewall and access point because I did not want those devices passing any type of password in plain text because that scared me to the point where I think now I'm the only Unify I have is in my house. So whoever's listening, trying to get in, Unify is your vector. I just OSINTed myself, but hey, such is life.
I don't use Unify as a router firewall because, I mean, they're not that, right?
Well, let's be honest. There's no such thing as a Unify router or firewall. There's a paperweight that's called a USG, but that's not really security. It's more the really nice cloud management console, which is what I think that thing should be as opposed to being billed as a firewall.
I mean, their IDS and IPS has been beta for over a year now.
But how effective is it? Has anyone actually tested it relative to, let's say, Meraki Go, which is their consumer-based product?
I don't know if anybody really has put it through its paces, to be honest with you. I know I keep talking about me wanting to put it through its paces to some degree. I just haven't had the time to actually, you know, really go through that. I guess if you were approaching a new hardware vendor, who would you, or what kind of questions would you start asking these guys? Because, like, I mean, we use Fortinet primarily for all of our clients, but, you know, I'm starting to ask them the questions. You know, I'm starting to ask them, you know, what's your policy, your VDP, your vulnerability disclosure program? What is, you know, how do you go back and look at your release notes? Are you actually disclosing in your release notes, hey, vulnerability, blah, 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 was patched. Here's a document on that kind of stuff. And Fortinet is doing a really good job, much like Microsoft, unfortunately, where we're all in a scramble. It's like, okay, here's the patch. By the way, we fixed 7-0 days. Hurry up and patch your shit. So it's kind of like, guys, can you wait a couple days before disclosing 0 days? At least let the patch get out into the wild a little bit. So it's making me starting to question at least that. But these are the kind of questions I'm starting to have again with my hardware vendors to figure out what's going on, to the point where I'm even considering even dropping Lenovo because of their update policy or their update software that enumerate or create a local administrator, runs commands, and then uninstalls that local or removes that local administrator account. And it sets off my EDR and all my SOC 4 or 5 times a day anytime that thing runs.
I got a notification from CrowdStrike yesterday that Dell's inventory manager was doing some similar things and they had to put in place various mitigations to deal with it. But going back to your thoughts on how we approach vendors, and I say vendors because it's not just the hardware guys. I think the software guys need to be held to a higher standard than we hold them to, if at all, right now. I think we need to have in-depth conversations with their CISOs and understand what their security protocols are. And I know that's hard for them to do. Right now, they can shroud it in secrecy saying, well, this is to protect ourselves. But going forward, if I am not happy with the security posture of a vendor, I will either not use them if they're not in the quiver, so to speak, or if they are a vendor of ours, I will drop them. You know better than most, I dropped my major RMM provider back in the summer of last year because of a security issue. So yeah, we need to hold them to a higher standard.
Yeah, you, me, and at least 4 or so other folks that close partners with, you know, we all like, yep, this is enough, we're done. And we all completely disrupted our entire business for about a month, replacing and ripping out and just redoing our entire methodology of doing anything. Man, to be honest with you, I'm still going through some of our stuff with our PSA because I still haven't got it configured and set up the way we need to. And that's just crazy.
But I feel that's a necessary evil. How can you put a product out there that represents you, your company, and everything you stand for when it's insecure? So it's something we had to do. We had no choice. And the lack of response is a response in my mind.
Even to this day, we are almost up at a 1 year, our agreement with our new partner. The old one still hasn't responded.
It's not on them to respond anymore. We're not their problem. They're not our problem. Fortunately, one of us had the incident and we shared it with everyone else to show this is a vector, this is a problem, and there was no response. And we need to apply that to every vendor in our arsenal. We can no longer just rely on their marketing to say they are the best.
The part that, you know, and I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second here, but the part that I'm really worried about is, you know, we're going to keep hopping from vendor to vendor because, you know, while they are, you know, good today, they may not be good next week.
My take on that is maybe not hop from vendor to vendor, but maybe thin out the herd. I know right now there are about 15 or 16 key points that need to be secured at a minimum across all my clients. And that can probably be done with maybe 7 or 8 vendors, maybe less. But I think we need to start ripping back layers of the onion because they're not actually providing any protection, and perhaps double down on more of the identity protection, the MFA, the basic user protection is what what we need. I would, dare I say, we probably need better protection of the user identity than we do a next-gen AV at this point in time, as far as entry goes into system. Not persistence and protection, but just as the entry point.
I don't know. I mean, I'm really torn on that one because I was actually literally having a conversation the other day with somebody about this whole topic. You know, when you're talking about an on-premise situation, then yeah, you're going to need your more of your firewall. You're going to need more of your AV. But if you're going after cloud assets, you're going after S3, you're going after AWS servers, you're going after all this stuff, then yeah, your identity is going to be critical, you know, protecting that. So I do think they need to be a 50-50, if you will, just because you don't know where the attack vector is going to come from. But it really depends on where their business is. So if the business is still legacy and on-premise, then maybe not so much focus on identity as much, depending on, you know, what they're doing, you know, a little bit case by case, but at least you got to start off at a 50-50 and kind of adjust if needed.
I think you got to do 100, 100, 100 across the board. I think you need
Doesn't that just equal burnout?
It does, but if you have the right vendors, you have the right processes and procedures, you can make a lot of headway. And that's one thing I've noticed in our industry. Many providers think they can fix a solution by just buying a product when the real fix or the real solution is people, processes, and procedures working together to work the problem.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I had the same conversation, I think about you or with you or, you know, at least with some folks, because I used to do SOFOs for a long time. Well, probably, I wouldn't say a long time, definitely about 6 months or so. And that was just after they acquired, or right around the time that they acquired Hitman Pro. They were doing all these acquisitions. And, well, it was great. They're bringing more, quote unquote, security to the space of the products that I'm bringing to my client. But it was turning into just massive amounts of bloatware. Like, I went from 4 services to 13 services in a week's time frame. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is becoming a noisy SOB.
You don't like having 35 processes for one program? That's not required.
No.
And I kid, it's not 35 processes. It's probably about 18 to 25, if that even makes a difference.
It's even higher.
No, it's lower. But that's the problem in our industry. Too many of our peers rely on the marketing of the distributors, the marketing of the vendors. And then these vendors get this fanboy status where if you speak out against a vendor, you have a large part of the channel coming after you. And it doesn't matter if you're right or you're correct in what you're saying.
Oh, exactly. And I mean, I'll just be, you know, open and candid about it. I mean, it was a week or two, I went after and took over a subdomain for TimeZip after they were being featured on a podcast of somebody that we know. And
shout out to Steve Taylor at Rocket MSP.
There we go. I didn't know if we wanted to plug his name or not, but there you go.
Rocket MSP. He's a friend of
there
the family.
There we go. He is that. But we went through, or I went through and, you know, found a subdomain very, very quickly and took it over and, you know, put a public display or a public notice saying, hey, friendly subdomain takeover. We quoted you there with peace and love and all that.
That's actually Ringo Starr. I've been white labeling his peace and love.
So, I mean, those are always the first interesting conversations I get to have with new companies. Like, hey, I did something, but I love you guys. But yeah, and the MSP vertical was like, why'd you do this? You're hacking. You're doing this. I'm like, no, you got to chill out. Calm down. Relax, take a breather. It's not that bad, I promise.
But you know, my thought is you have to break shit to improve. If you're not in pain, you're not growing.
This is true.
Stasis is the worst thing, in my opinion. Staying still, stagnant, not making any progress, not changing with the times and evolving with threats or just evolving with life. I want nothing to do with that or anyone who enjoys that.
Yeah. And that kind of goes into, I guess, some of the next topics that we'll have coming up here soon around, you know, the new federal C compliances that we've kind of hinted around with CMMC3 and stuff like that. I know I got some calls coming up in the next week or so. I know you've got some calls coming up around the whole security space with some of your clients and whatnot. So I think the next couple of weeks are going to be really interesting as we bring some of the new information to be out and let everybody be aware of the whole situation that's going on.
You know, touching on CMMC without going too crazy about it, I am starting to see the ripple effects downstream. You know, we're not nearly big enough to be a prime, but we're a few layers down in the supply chain for certain clients of ours. And I am starting to see the reviews coming for the tool sets that are deployed. And I give it about a year before the entire supply chain has to be in line with some version of CMMC. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to really start, people are going to have to start focusing in line, whether they have to be compliant with a regulatory body or not. They are going to have to do something. We got to start taking security seriously. People will start, you know, we've talked about this Florida got to be held to a new higher standard, a new credible standard. And
what is that standard in terms of security? If you think about it, my version of security of what I roll out to my clients is likely slightly different to yours because we are peers, we are colleagues, we discuss things offline, but put us up against the average MSP out there who's putting out something like just an RMM, some basic patching, and some RMM. What exactly are these guys doing?
Oh, absolutely. You put any of our band of goofball friends together, and I mean, the difference of security and complexity that these guys will actually roll out is staggering.
And it's not that they're doing it wrong or we're doing it right. I just think there's no actual standard that says every company should have A, B, C, D, E, F, G in place at the bare minimum, and then anything else layered on top. What I would like to see with CMMC is you take the five levels and you have a singular compliancy set. Get rid of HIPAA, get rid of Sarbanes-Oxley, get rid of everything else and make it a tiered system like CMMC. This way you have one set of auditors, you have one set of review boards, and now you rebuild each level to deal with the complexities needed. Because I don't care if you're a financial firm or hospital, an accounting firm, or even a plumber. I think there are certain things that need to be done security-wise across the board for every client that has a computer attached to the internet.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's where a lot of the countries are really starting to excel past us in the cybersecurity space. You know, they don't have the problems of these things that some of us do. Now, you know, I will say that with a big asterisk on top of it, because I know for a fact that there are countries out there that are like, okay, you know, we're from Russia, we're not going to hack China, we're not going to do the whack of these people, those people, or whatever, you know, so they don't have some of the major problems that, you know, we face coming from ATP nation states, but it's definitely still a problem, absolutely. I really think looking at the CMMC levels, level one, no offense, is a joke.
Level two is no better. You're only logging and starting to do aggregation at level three. Level one and two, I would not even call crawling.
This is true. I don't know. It's, yes, granted, we got to start somewhere. I 100% agree. Where is that? I don't know. You know, I think I'm on board with you. I do think that we should be at a level three at a minimum for any and all businesses. Outside of, you know, logging credit card information, let's take your local Jiffy Lube or your local quick oil change. Outside of credit card information, is there really anything that's really critical, really important? I'm fair to say no, maybe.
How about one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who brings their car in? That could be a location where it's compromised, where things can be done.
Maybe.
If they're plugging
in. Goes into the PCI information, isn't it? Because,
I'm going deeper. I'm going into the car itself. Let's say, could we classify that OBD2 port industrial control systems?
Good point. I did not think of. You're correct.
Okay. So with cars getting smarter, not necessarily the Tesla smart, but what's to stop anyone from uploading code to mess with the drive-by-wire or brake-by-wire system?
Oh, there's none. I mean,
if that is done, how are we going to know the who, what, when, where, why, and how it was done? If there's no, I guarantee you, the Jiffy Lubes of the world aren't logging those, you know, what I term the industrial control system.
Absolutely. That's really going to be interesting because, I mean, every year at, you know, B5 or Hack5 or, you know, whatever hacking fest that you want to refer to, there's always guys and gals out there that are breaching into Teslas, they're breaching into Honda and GMC and OnStar and all these other things. The one thing that surprised me, and it shouldn't have surprised me, but it really did. So I whipped out my old Android phone last week to go out to look at a client's Wi-Fi signal. And on there, I seen a thing where I can start scanning for local Bluetooth low energy signal. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. It didn't dawn on me at the time. I don't know why, but it just didn't. I guess it's, you know, what you know or what you think about is pertinent. But my GMC car, SUV, whatever you want to call it, it emits a low frequency Bluetooth to receive my key fob information. I'm like, duh. But until I thought about it last week, I'm like, I never thought about it. I mean, there's so much Bluetooth hijacking going on. I can't tell you the last time my phone was ever or my car was ever updated for Bluetooth vulnerabilities. How about yours? And I have OnStar.
I think nowadays there are updates going if you're getting serviced at the dealership. If you're not getting serviced at a dealership, I don't think you're getting some of those firmware updates. But while we're on this topic, I think last week around April 2nd or April 3rd, Bleeping Computer put out a report on App Plus Technologies, which does the vehicle inspections for Connecticut, Georgia, Massachusetts, Utah, Wisconsin and maybe one or two other states, and they suffered a cyber attack. And again, these are the testing companies that plug in directly to your automobiles. Who's to say code could not have been dropped in, just as what was done with SolarWinds, to cause accidents? There's no telling. Safety features for lane changing alerts with cars coming, anti-collision software, and no one seems to care. Everyone just seems to think, okay, what's next? Because we live in a, not even a 2-week news cycle anymore, we live in a 2-day cycle.
Sometimes 30 seconds, depending on your TikTok or Twitter feed.
I'm a fan of TikTok. You leave TikTok alone, you hear me? But
next week on this podcast.
The only reason SolarWinds is still relevant today is not because of the national security implications. It's because the SolarWinds breach is the breach that keeps on giving, with new vectors, new attacks, and new information being uncovered on a near weekly or bi-weekly basis.
You know, let's bring that up, because I haven't had a chance to research, but you were talking about it the other day. You were seeing reports SolarWinds Orion was still in production in DOD and local municipalities. Is that correct?
From my understanding of CISA guidance, it's still being used. There are certain mitigations put in place, which was to take it off of the internet. Feasibly, it can only be used on the internet, and there were patches issued. I don't think the way our national security infrastructure is built in terms of civilian government organizations, they can just pivot and move to something else. There's a whole procurement process that needs to be done, and SolarWinds is already there, which would lead me to believe it's far easier to mitigate the threat and monitor the threat than to actually pull up stakes and switch software. On the other hand, what is the alternative? Where do they go if they were to leave Orion?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, to SolarWinds credit, as much as it pains me to say this, but the Orion software really is a monitor for these networks. That's why it really took off. The only thing that I think that will really come close is getting out of an RMM space really would be PRTG. That would give them a lot of the feasibility and insight that they're looking for on a network.
You know, before the SolarWinds breach was made public to us in, I think it was early December, they were planning on spinning out their managed services division, which is now called Enable. And I think they were doing that because the managed services side of their business was a dead weight to the SolarWinds company, because their enterprise business is a solid business. They have solid product, and it's not built on the constant acquisitions that we see in the MSP space, where it's just relabeled and development stops. The sad part about SolarWinds is, and you know, I have to give whoever the hackers were credit for this, it was quite the elegant hack or breach the way they did it. They got deep into the code signing. It was impressive, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So much as I hate to say it, but the guys and gals who did this attack they've got to be nation state, because if any other person who's going after profit, they go in, they exfiltrate, they encrypt, they're done, right? These folks took the time to see who was phoning back home, were they important, delete the ones that weren't important, and, you know, quietly move forward.
Did you review how the hack or how the breach staged? There were timers and logic where if it's a new installation, don't activate in case you're in a sandbox. Wait 2 weeks or 3 weeks to do something.
Mm-hmm.
That was planning. They even pushed test malware code to see if it would get caught. And when went through, they just went full bore on them. And I often wonder, did FireEye discover this breach? Because the bad actors wanted to be discovered, so focus would be put there so they can put their resources somewhere else. Misdirection, if you will.
It's an interesting thought. I have watched how they go in, you know, the sleep timers that they put in, like you said, the test codes that they put in to see. They would never, it was so clever that they would use their payload to drop a different payload that was obfuscated from their existing, just to see what EDRs and stuff like that out there may do when they start beginning home.
What about the fact that they hid their traffic, or they obfuscated their traffic to mimic that of legitimate Orion traffic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as much as I hate to say it, it was a piece of art. It really, really was. It's definitely one that the analysts are still going through and just simply amazed. They are just in awe and things to be studied. There's a lot of data to learn that still hasn't even come out, that I'm sure the DOD is still analyzing to this day to figure out how the F did this get pulled off again? And I love how SolarWinds was just like, oh, well, they got in because some intern set the password to SolarWinds 123. No,
that was their GitHub. They blamed that on the intern, not Orion. But here's a question that I have for you. What government institution were you most surprised that uses Orion?
I was really surprised about Department of Homeland Security.
Really?
I think so.
Homeland was put together after Crisis, so they probably used whatever they could have gotten then and made it better, I'm sure, with, you know, they help with the development. But the one agency that has been publicly listed as a user of Orion blew my mind, and that is the NSA. Wouldn't you think?
I forgot about
the. Wouldn't you think the NSA would have built their own product and not use something off the shelf?
Or, I mean, I would imagine coding that out would take a lot of work, right? So I get the.
But we're talking about the NSA, Cyber Command.
Yeah.
You know, if they can't do it.
I think I would be more on the side, honestly, of why are they not catching this situation before FireEye?
Hubris.
Whether, you build it out yourself or whatever, but they should have been the first ones to catch it, I would think.
Well, how did FireEye catch it?
I don't know. That hasn't been public knowledge yet.
FireEye detected access to subsystems related to government agencies. They did their investigation. They saw what they saw. Now, this goes back to, my thought of, was that done for misdirection? Did they trip a wire so FireEye would discover it and the entire world would look at SolarWinds while they have a whole nother vector into all the system?
It's a good point. It's a good point. I mean,
it's all conjecture.
Exactly.
I don't have clearance. I don't know who's doing what. So it is what it is in that sense.
Unfortunately. I know we got some stuff that we're going to be talking about in, next week's show coming up with CMMC and things of that nature. But is there any other topics you want to kind of cover before we wrap this one up?
No, just maybe a recap of our last show, which is please use MFA, even if it's text message, but hopefully not. Protect yourself. Protect your people.
Absolutely.
How about you?
Stop freaking being so blind. Stop trusting everything. Always question, always be inquisitive, and be asking your vendors. If you're a business, you're a C-level suite, or you're in the IT department, start asking your external vendors, your MSPs, your external IT consultants, start asking them questions and drill down. We even had a buddy of ours who recently said as well that they have vendors that they're having conversations in the vetting process that they don't ask them the same questions that we were asking them. It's alarming. I mean, we are less than 10 people asking some of the most sophisticated questions to a lot of these vendors, and they're surprised by it when there's, I don't know, at least 5 million quote-unquote IT MSP professionals out there.
Well, they're at least 5 million people that call themselves IT professionals. I may not agree with 99.9% of them, but hey, if they are the tip of the spear, God help us.
If they are the tip of the spear, then I am tip of the speared mushroom, sir. All right, guys, gals, thank you so much for joining this week's podcast on cybersecurity, Amplified and Intensified. If you like this thing, if you like our show, please subscribe. Please join us next week on Clubhouse. We're there twice a week, and we'll see y'all in the next episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Take care. Thanks again for joining us for the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified podcast.